If we have, a cooperative ownership and local control, we get more dollars back from those clean energy systems. We get more benefit. You know, cost, the cheapness of the kilowatt hour is not the only factor. It's also where does that payment go? Is it going to, a big company that's not based in our community and ultimately to shareholders, Wall Street and around the world? Or are those dollars going back to, my neighbor down the block?
On the north side of Minneapolis, Minnesota, there's a garbage burning plant and some pretty heavy industry. But now, thanks in part to Cooperative Energy Futures, a for-profit energy efficiency and renewable energy cooperative based in Minneapolis, there will be a community solar garden as well. Timothy Denherter Thomas, general manager of Cooperative Energy Futures, joins John Farrell this week to talk about the Shiloh Temple Community Solar Garden and getting the economic benefits of clean energy to the people who need it most. This is Local Energy Rules, a podcast sharing powerful stories about local renewable energy.
So we're excited this week with Local Energy Rules to have our second in-studio interview ever with Timothy Denherter Thomas. He's the general manager of Cooperative Energy Futures, which has been providing energy efficiency and renewable energy services to members in the Twin Cities since 2009. Timothy, welcome to the program.
Thank you, John.
I want to start this off. There's a lot of ferment and interesting things happening in Minnesota, especially around community solar. The law was passed in 2013. We've been on a slow walk to the launch of the program, no thanks to the incumbent electric utility, but some things are finally starting to develop. Your organization has been working in this space prior to that law on both energy efficiency and renewable energy. Can you tell us, why did you want to form a cooperative? Why did you want to use the cooperative structure for your organization?
Sure. So a large part of what we see in the current energy system is that people who use energy pay on a monthly basis on their energy bills to a large utility, and there's profits in that. There's wealth being generated for the investors in those utilities. But the majority of people have no option or no real way to get that wealth and keep it in their community to reinvest the energy dollars that they're paying to get electricity and heat in local jobs, in renewable energy that they own. And building a cooperative was really about creating an economic entity that could help people work together to create clean energy and energy efficiency in a way that they could get that benefit. They could get those energy dollars flowing back into their own hands individually, but also into a cooperative business where they could make decisions together about how to reinvest that in the energy future that they want to see.
So capturing the wealth, giving people more decision-making authority, that sounds wonderful. And you've actually started off in terms of your community solar work with a project on the Shiloh Temple on the north side of Minneapolis. Can you explain a little bit about how that project is different from the other kinds of community solar projects that are being developed? And, does it cost more to do it in a way that is involving more of the community?
Sure. So there's, I'd say, a number of major differences. One is size. So a lot of the solar gardens that we're seeing developed in Minnesota are 1 megawatt projects, usually ground mounted in a field somewhere. Several developers are locating multiple 1 megawatt gardens in the same place. So it's ultimately 5 megawatts or so of solar. The initial proposals were for even more than that, but Xcel successfully got a negotiation that cut it down to 5. The solar garden we're developing on Shiloh is just under 200 kilowatts. So it's a much smaller system, and it's rooftop. So we are avoiding a lot of the challenges with using productive agricultural land or productive habitat that a lot of these larger developers are using. And additionally, a lot of the projects that are currently in application process for Xcel are facing interconnection problems. So they're developing in sites where Xcel doesn't have or doesn't say that they have enough substation and transmission infrastructure. And then there's very expensive delays and upgrades to that infrastructure to be able to bring those solar gardens online. I can't really say to what degree that is a real technical barrier versus just something that Xcel is popping up to slow the process down. By doing a system that is much smaller and in the city, there's a lot of existing electrical infrastructure to tap into. And so we streamline the process that way. I think the other really big difference is that most of the solar developers in the solar community here are primarily installers. They are entities that build and develop solar arrays, their primary interest is to make money off of the installation of solar and the ongoing subscription payments that they get off of that. And to do that as quickly as possible, they tend to work with large financing entities, some of which we are, you know, collaborating with and exploring our relationship to finance these arrays. But I think what really sets us apart as a cooperative is our primary purpose is to maximize our benefit to our members. So the people who subscribe in our arrays, that's who we serve. Any money that the cooperative makes goes back to those members, whether that's in cash or equity. So it's really benefiting the people that it serves. And that means that our decision-making process is somewhat different. You know, we are not trying to do the largest volume at any cost. We are not trying to get the most value we can out of our members, because again, the more value we get out of our members for our Solar Garden subscriptions, the more we send right back to them. Given our smaller scale and the fact that we are trying to be very creative with access, so making sure that our Solar Garden subscriptions are accessible to residents, and particularly low-income residents and residents with low credit scores, there are some just harder things in terms of the financing in our model. But the rates that we're seeing for our solar gardens over the long term in particular are very competitive, and especially with the escalators that we're using on the prices of subscriptions, actually substantially better than a lot of what I'm seeing in the market.
Sorry, when you talk about escalators, you're talking about the amount that somebody pays for the subscription will go up over time for other community solar projects. Folks will pay more over time for their subscription, and the Shiloh project that Cooperative Energy Futures is doing does not escalate at the same rate.
That's correct. We've designed our subscriptions so that the cost of a subscription rises modestly for the first few years and then is essentially flat, because we want this to be a safeguard or a protection for our subscribers against rising energy costs. So the higher energy costs rise, which also increases the bill credits they get, the more money they will save on their energy. So we're kind of flatlining the cost of energy for our subscribers over time. We're also different in that we are using a hybrid model, and there's some developers that are doing this, but we are offering upfront subscriptions as well as kind of the monthly pay-as-you-go subscriptions, which allows people who have more resources to put more money in upfront in a way that both reduces our financing cost, and for those subscribers means that they have almost no payment on an annual basis over time. So it's more like installing solar on your own roof one time, except it's much cheaper, and you get benefits for 25 years. So our intention is to really create a cooperative where low-income communities and more middle- and upper-income communities can work together to finance and develop these types of systems through a range of subscriptions that really works for them.
So why do you think others aren't using the cooperative structure?
Yeah, I think the main reason that we're not seeing as much of the cooperative structure is just because it adds a complication, and it's another body of work that brings more people into the process and therefore more decision makers into the process. And requires, I think, more intentionality and more working with a complex group of people to pull a project together. Again, that is our mission, our interest. It's why we exist as a cooperative. That's not primarily why most developers exist. They exist to get as much solar installed as possible in a way that's profitable for them. And so, you know, the process of having to consult a board to design your subscription agreements in a way that's really taking the feedback of community groups and people in the community who want to subscribe, of, you know, developing the workforce programs like we've done around the Shiloh project, where we're actually training people from the community on the job in the solar garden, that's all more work, and it's not the core of their business model. And, you know, I think it's kind of seen as just a complication. And it is a complication, but we also see it as an added value. And it's an added value for our members, and it's worth it for us to do that.
I mean, it certainly seems like in the way that people conceptualize what a community-based renewable energy project looks like, that a cooperative is sort of truer to that philosophy and to that ideal in terms of making sure that the focus is on the return of community benefits and not just the returning of some benefits to the community, kind of whatever's left over after the developer takes their cut.
I would totally agree with that. You know, I am quite concerned that a lot of the solar gardens that I'm seeing are being developed in a way that, you know, it's good on paper because it's cheaper than doing nothing. And, you know, solar gardens in general are cheaper than doing nothing. But if people aren't really looking at the comparison between that and what could you save if you really had a stake in the overall, the flow of value, it wasn't just whatever the developer was willing to give you. You know, I think people would, you know, really start to ask some tougher questions about how are we sharing in the benefits of this, and what do we as subscribers and we as energy users really deserve.
I just finished writing a piece at the beginning of September looking at what might happen when the federal tax credit is scheduled to expire at the end of 2016. And the reason I bring this up, of course, is that, you know, for a lot of these developers, capturing that tax credit is such a big issue, and I'm sure it is for you as well. I'm curious, you know, in general, and hopefully with some reference to the federal tax credit and the complications that it adds, what would make it easier to do more community-based energy, whether by a cooperative structure or not?
Yeah, I actually think the way that we finance renewable energy primarily through tax incentives is one of the greatest barriers to community ownership of clean energy. You know, a lot of solar developers are extremely concerned about the expiration of the federal tax credit. We definitely have concerns as a cooperative, but it's also an opportunity for us if we can get the cost of our service down enough, because, you know, we may actually be able to get to a place where we can cut a lot of those financing relationships out of the picture. And that would actually be a really strong value to our members, because a huge amount of the cash of these projects gets eaten up by the demands of large investors. And right now that's
the middlemen between you and the capital.
Exactly. And to the extent as a cooperative that we can actually source our capital from our members at, you know, rates of return and, you know, terms of loans and all of those things that are quite good. They're a lot better than most people could get, you know, investing in a bank or a CD or, you know, any of those basic types of things. So providing good returns to our members, but are also a lot more modest than, you know, what Wall Street is looking for. And those are opportunities as we look more at, you know, crowdfunding models of investment and member loans and all the types of capital that we can start to pool as a cooperative. And especially as we've done this a couple of times, so we can demonstrate a track record of what these projects look like. We see it as a huge opportunity to cut a lot more of the financial waste out of these projects and direct more of the benefits to the community. And I think, you know, at a state or federal level, if the state or federal government could design incentives for renewable energy that wouldn't just benefit people with a lot of passive income, which is very, very wealthy individuals and corporations, it would really level the playing field and make it much easier for community-based energy to come forward. So whether that was a, you know, standard incentive per kilowatt hour generated, or you know, a tax benefit that was refundable and not related to passive income, so it was accessible to just about anyone.
Just to clarify, the passive income piece is money that you might make off of investments that you're not, you know,
exactly,
as they say, materially participating in.
Yes. So right now, a lot of these tax incentives require that you make a lot of your income, a lot of income on investments. And, you know, how many ordinary people living in our community make a substantial portion of their income on investments? There obviously are some of us. But, you know, especially if you're talking about low-income residents or even middle-income residents, we're making most of our income off of, you know, a job or, you know, whatever else we're doing to make a living. It's really very wealthy people and larger corporations who have that investment income to be able to qualify for the tax credits currently. So if we could move away from that, it would really make it much more accessible for ordinary people to do renewable energy and not rely as much on kind of the big Wall Street investors.
You know, I'm interested in, particularly you mentioned crowd financing. You know, I just saw a story in the New York Times recently about how this area had a lot of promise. And it seemed it was a way that, you know, especially after the financial crisis, there were new rules put into place to help protect people when they, from, you know, securities fraud, which basically means somebody's coming around asking you for money and saying you can make money in return. There are rules about how you have to file and with the Securities and Exchange Commission and kind of the compliance with that and the audits and whatnot, and that can all be very expensive. And they said, and folks were saying, but for these small scale things like renewable energy projects, a community solar project on a church or whatever, You know, the level of risk is relatively low. The amount of money is relatively low. We need some rules that make this easier to do. Crowd financing was kind of the concept behind this. There was a federal legislation in 2012, now 3 years ago, which still the rules haven't been written for. Is something going to come of that that's going to benefit the way that we can develop community-based renewable energy? Is the cooperative model one way to get around needing that? What's the future there?
So, yes and yes, but it's a bit more complicated. I am not super convinced that the federal crowdfunding rules are going to yield something that's super beneficial in the short term, just because I had my hopes up and it has been 3 years and we haven't gotten real regulations. A lot of states are pursuing crowdfunding strategies and crowdfunding laws, and we actually just passed one here in Minnesota this session that are supposed to write clearer rules for crowdfunding and crowdfunded investment. And I am hopeful about those programs within the specific states, and I've heard lots of successes in other states that have adopted this previously. So I think that that's a big opportunity. The other thing that you're asking about is the cooperative model itself does provide some ways to finance projects from the membership of the co-op that already is exempt from securities regulations. And you still have to do some amount of legal paperwork, but it's between 5 to 10% of the cost of registering a security federally. The limitation there is that you can really only take that financing from your members, and it gets complex, but really the intention is that those members have to be materially involved in the co-op. Like, they have to be doing some solar garden subscriptions or residential insulation or whatever it is that the co-op is doing in order to be considered a member and be able to invest. You can't just become a member just to invest. And there's some gray area around that, but that's more or less what...
So you might have to either be a subscriber, or, for example, there are kinds of co-ops where it might be a bunch of... solar installers, for example, could become members of a co-op doing community solar, and they would all be members and could help finance community solar projects.
Sure, exactly. And that has been a challenge for us in our early stages because we haven't had kind of a mass market offering like community solar. It's been people who are ready to insulate their own homes, people who are ready to put solar on their own homes. And that's a relatively small number of people. It's not a big enough range to generate very much capital. But as we start building a base of members that are in it primarily for solar garden subscriptions, we're looking more and more at those member-based financing strategies.
So I'm curious, you know, this is sort of a big picture question to end with, but it's the last question I have, which is, you know, what you're developing this project in North Minneapolis, a community solar project. You're doing it as a cooperative. But in the big picture, what's the advantage of developing solar like this at the small scale, at the community level, versus letting the utility go out and bid for a big project and get a really low price, well, at least a really low price for the energy generated, wherever it is that it is, and then, you know, they have to then put it on transmission lines and bring it off to cities. So I'm hinting already, I think, at an answer and a perspective that we have here, but what do you see as the benefit of developing projects at the community level?
Yeah, I think that there's a few, and the first ones are technical, kind of what you've been pointing at. Yes, you can generate solar at the... you know, at the meter, at a much cheaper price if you do it giant solar farm somewhere out in the country. But then you have to get it to the place where people use it. And the transmission and the substations and all of that infrastructure upgrades add substantially to the cost. And, you know, I've seen numbers, not that it necessarily puts you all the way up into the price range of, you know, what a small community solar project would be, but it eats up a lot of the difference. I think the second thing also at a technical end is, how valuable is that energy as part of the overall portfolio of grid assets? So when you have peak power usage periods, usually in cities in the summer, what is the value of having a relatively peak-matched solar resource right there in the community where that peak power event is happening, as opposed to, you know, 100 miles away, where you already have a lot of transmission constraints, and what do you have to build for those transmission constraints in those specific peak power times? What is the added value of local solar in that?
And then before you go on, just about the peak power thing, just in case we have some listeners who are not energy wonks like the two of us, when we're talking about peak power, it's a time on the grid when energy use is peaking. That's hence the term. So
a hot sunny summer day in the city in August when air conditioners are running full tilt and, you know, businesses are open and everything is all happening at the same time.
Yeah, and solar, if you orient it straight south, does not perfectly match peak power resources, but if we actually rewarded solar for that value, it could incentivize orienting solar, for example, slightly southwest to better match those times. And the other thing is just as we're looking at building an energy future where you rely less and less on fossil fuels and other dirty energy sources, we have the potential, if we distribute our renewable energy with a lot of different technology in a lot of different places, for that renewable energy to start backing each other up. You know, if you have one giant solar array in a big field somewhere, and it's a partly cloudy day, and there just happens to be a cloud that drifts over that solar array, you have a huge loss of power. But if you have 5,000 little solar arrays spread out all over the place, you'll either have a partly cloudy day, and some of them will be off and others will be on, and it'll be fine overall, especially when you add in wind and other renewable energy sources. Or if you know there's a big giant front coming through and the whole area is going to be cloudy, you can predict that from the weather ahead of time. You know, we can predict and project and do energy planning based on those large-scale weather events. We can't predict very well whether there's going to be a cloud over some specific parcel of land at 10:30 a.m. tomorrow. And so distributing renewable energy makes renewable energy much more predictable, and it allows it to provide a larger portion of the total energy that we need and not require as much backup from natural gas and other dirty energy sources. Those are kind of the technical reasons for why do you go smaller and why do you go community-based. But I think that there's an even more important one, which is kind of the social and political and just how do we build a movement for a more sustainable future. It's very well demonstrated that in communities where utilities have come in and built giant renewable energy projects that, don't have a local benefit or don't have a local ownership component, maybe create a few jobs in the near term, but maybe they don't even hire those jobs in the community, or it's just a short-term thing, that people get really pissed off. And understandably, this is just another form of extracting wealth from a community, just the way we've been extracting wealth from our communities through coal plants and natural gas plants and nuclear plants and all this other big infrastructure. And that's a very good way to ensure that renewable energy is just as opposed and really not very engaging to communities as all the other big infrastructure we've had. And it seems to me like a very good strategy, whether it's intentional or not, for generating backlash to renewables. If instead we give people the opportunity to own and control their own energy, it's a direct benefit to those communities, and people demand it, people want it, people want renewable energy in their community. And all of a sudden, we have this kind of self-perpetuating loop of more and more communities saying, why can't we do that too? And that's both just a social and emotional thing. I want to get my power from clean energy, but it's also a financial thing. If we have, a cooperative ownership and local control, we get more dollars back from those clean energy systems. We get more benefit. You know, cost, the cheapness of the kilowatt hour, is not the only factor. It's also, where does that payment go? Is it going to, a big company that's not based in our community and ultimately to shareholders, Wall Street and around the world? Or are those dollars going back to, my neighbor down the block who's employed installing solar systems, and, 50 of us in our neighborhood who all get a share of the profits at the end of the year? And when we really look at it from a value perspective like that, as opposed to just cost, I think that there's a lot of ways in which local community control that renewable energy is a much higher value and really benefits people a lot more.
Well, Timothy, we'll be excited to see how your work progresses with Cooperative Energy Futures. It's a future all of us could look forward to.
Thank you, John. It's been exciting to talk and exciting to build out this cooperative model of community solar.
That was Timothy Denherter-Thomas, General Manager of Cooperative Energy Futures, talking to John Farrell, ILSR's Director of Democratic Energy. For more information about the Shiloh Temple Community Solar Garden and Cooperative Energy Futures, please visit the website cooperativeenergyfutures.com. More information about community solar gardens and a plethora of other solar policies and practices can be found on ilsr.org, where you can also find 27 more Local Energy Rules podcasts. Until next time, keep your energy local. and thanks for listening.